also just want to mention some of the things that one of the famous martyrs from Hoxha defense, Ibrahim Hadi, did, because for him, being fit was actually very important. So he understood this very well. See, for example, was a good sports player, and he would actually give advice in terms of fitness. So at one point, he gave very unusual advice. He said, for example, so he was bringing faith and sort of health together, and they do go together. He said that if you want to get in shape, first of all, you should choose good friends and not go astray. And you should live a healthy life and not be corrupt. And to be successful in sports, you have to turn to God and live a healthy life. So there's a lot in there. So good friends, stay on the path, not become deviated, not be corrupt. So I'm going to leave that there, all these other aspects, and just emphasize again and again, if we're on the straight path and we have this in terms of akhlaq, very good and beautiful life, but we're neglecting our physical health or even our mental health, now that is, we really need to make some changes then. So I pray that all of us can make the changes that we need to. And that was it for today, and farewell for now. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Iron Boomish Radio. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
I guess I get so furious when people think it's anti-Semitic and that Palestinians are walking around as just raging anti-Semites in the desert. So much of the Palestinian cause and everything I've engaged with is deeply aware of everything you just said. They know the trauma of the Jew really, really, like, intimately.
Right.
And they perversely also have come to know that they are its victim of that trauma. And in my reading, maybe this is just too nice, I've been incredibly patient with bearing the brunt of a lot of that sort of anger for some time. But it seems that maybe it's over. Maybe the clock is ticking on that. You know which poem I'm actually referencing now, which is the what is it? I will eat my robber's flesh, or something like that.
Yes. This is Darwish, and Darwish is really interesting. You know, he's really that first generation who lived through the Nakba but ended up in Israel, right? So Darwish is the Palestinian poet in a lot of ways. He's known not just in Palestine but all of the Arab world for his very powerful, especially his early poems. But he actually was fluent in Hebrew. He went to school in Hebrew. He fell in love with a Jewish woman. The stories about this woman he calls Rita and some of the poetry is a Jewish woman that he couldn't be with because neither one of their families would allow it. He knew Israeli culture inside and out, but he was Palestinian and he was unintimidated by that. You know, he wanted to speak for Palestine and the right of Palestinians, and he did so from his first book of poetry was published when he was 20, I think. And in some ways, that first book of poetry is very radical. I think the poem that you were talking about is Identity Card.
Yes, yeah.
So this is, there'll be all these skipping around the poem to just read what I put in the book. Write down, I'm an Arab, and my identity card number is 50,000. I have 8 children, and the ninth is due after summer. Does this anger you? I do not hate people, nor do I steal. But if I become hungry, I will eat my robber's flesh. Beware then, beware of my hunger and my anger.
I would like for you to, this might seem like a layup, but you've been teaching for quite a while and you have seen, like I think all professors in this space, a drastic change in your students and their interest in this, maybe their attitudes in this, maybe that famous Overton window that everyone talks about is blown wide open from when you started. Can you tell me how October 7th changed your classroom? Either perhaps your teaching, if you realize you're able to open up certain things you've never been able to say before, and maybe the students are just different, and maybe it's a bit of that hunger that Darwish was was referencing, because it's not just Palestinian hunger now, it's feeling like a global kind of hunger.
I noticed the change starting before October 7th, definitely. And in fact, some of my friends and I had been talking before COVID, and we're talking about how the students were changing in their willingness to hear about Palestine, their sense of criticalness of Israel, the ways they understood that issue to be deeply connected to anti-colonialism that they were interested in their own lives. Part of the change has to do with the changing demographics, at least where I was teaching at George Washington University. It became a more multiracial international student body over time. But it also has to do with the organizing work that people were doing here, and particularly the BDS movement, which I was not super in favor of at first. I thought it would really get us into trouble, basically, which, you know, it did. But what I under-respected or didn't realize was that it really gave people something to do, something nonviolent, something that wasn't requiring you to go out every Wednesday and Thursday night and join in a protest, but that actually people could organize around boycotting Soda Stream, for example, or you know, other kind of products from Israel, or having their academic institutions declare boycotts of working with Israeli state institutions, and so that brought it home to a lot of people and kind of ordinary people, not just academics. But I wasn't teaching in 23-24, I was on a fellowship, so I didn't see the immediate change in my students. I didn't have those conversations with students right then. I mean, I had them with the faculty and with other people, but when I came back and was teaching the next year, it was like I was in a different place. I mean, I had been back in town. I was at GW the day of the first encampment began. I just happened to have been around, and then I knew it was happening, so I went down there. So I got to see the beginnings of the encampments and know there were a lot of American studies majors who were doing the encampments, not surprisingly. But when I came back and started teaching in fall 24, and I was teaching my U.S. in the World course, I was talking about a lot of things, not just related to Israel-Palestine at all. In fact, mostly hardly any. But when we did talk about it, students were incredibly receptive and interested from the beginning, from the first day, in ways that had never happened. So in the first day when I teach this U.S. in the World course, I teach it as a course about the United States as an empire in the 20th century. It starts in 1898. And so I give them a lecture about different kinds of empire. Cultural empire, extractive empire, settler colonialism, blah, blah, blah. And I relate all of them to the United States. The first question I got on the first day, my first teaching in the fall of 24, somebody raises his hand and says, now in terms of settler colonialism, can both sides in a settler colonial situation be oppressed? And I was like, here I am trying to subtly raise some points, and you immediately, you know, sort of basically bring up Israel-Palestine. So it has been an extraordinary opportunity to teach during these moments, to teach at moments when students are very concerned to think. Again, they're sort of, I imagine they're like, I would have been wanting to get this right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a moral issue as well as a political issue, or they are often intertwined. And trying to understand how not to be anti-Semitic, but how to be pro-Palestinian, and can they do that, and what does that mean? And in all sorts of fights about it with friends and other students and in classrooms. But the conversation is one in which, I mean, if pro-Israel students say they feel on the defensive in many situations, that's probably not wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not everywhere, but in places like GW, definitely the student population tends to be more receptive to a Palestinian narrative than I've ever seen, and probably at this point more receptive to a Palestinian narrative than an Israeli one. Now, that's not true at many places, and in many parts of the university it's not true. But it gets, I think that pro-Israel students are not accustomed to that. You know, the Palestinian students have had to defend who they are and every right, even the very idea of being a people who have rights, even being a people who are not liars from birth, people, you know, actually defend themselves as moral human beings in the world. And that's been what they've had to do from time immemorial, basically. And they know what that feels like, but I think a lot of the pro-Israel students have not ever experienced that before, having to be on the defensive, and they find that very uncomfortable.
With that being said, you said that they're receptive to Palestinian narratives more so than Israeli narratives. I imagine they're telling their own narratives as well, not just receiving, but they must be spinning it back to you. Are they surprising you in some ways of what they might want to do with this? Like your activist story, like you said, went through the two-state cross pin thing that everyone did. And I don't know if they're making the same kind of noises. You did write a little bit about stuff that's close to my heart of thinking in maybe, you know, post-national ways and the nation state itself being maybe a flawed concept. But I guess I'm asking you as someone who's closer to these students, is like, what are they doing with the conversation that maybe is surprising you or maybe making you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we don't, in my big, you know, it's 50 students and sometimes it's 100 students, this U.S. in the World class, and sometimes even bigger. We don't, at some point I was giving them part of the history of the 1967 war, and I was like, look, I'm not telling you what my plan for solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you want to come to my office and talk about that, we can, but what I am telling you is what happened in 1967. It's my perspective, of course, but like, not, there's not some secret behind trying to say, and therefore this proves that, because I really think it's too complicated for there to be these kind of simple moral lessons from one war or another. But the students, I think, are quite... one story we do have in that class is the ways in which, after starting in the 1940s, a lot of conflicts were solved, quote, solved, were handled by partitioning.
Yeah.
So we study, you know, Pakistan and India and Israel-Palestine, and then in 1967, we're not only studying the 1967 war, but we're also studying the 1967 civil war in Nigeria, where Biafra broke off as a separate state and was unsustainable as a separate state. And so it's not like every time they break off and make a state, that goes really well. It's not like it's always a bad idea, but it definitely has been the logic of ethnic states to become smaller and smaller and smaller, right? More and more specific about who's involved or who's included in a particular state. And so I try to at least raise the possibility that ethnic states are, you know, a fantasy solution to a lot of things. And Biafra is actually, interestingly, a really good example, because the Igbo people in Biafra were, this is again, it's also happening in 1967, the two wars start within 3 weeks of each other. Everybody said, oh, we're going to make an Igbo state in Biafra, but there were 200 different ethnic groups in this tiny little place of Biafra, and a lot of them didn't like the Igbo domination. But, you know, Biafra was the size, I don't know, the size of North Carolina or something, so you couldn't really break it up to much smaller states. And so one of the things I do all semester implicitly is raise questions about the difference between self-determination and statehood. Like, could people, there are a lot of different ways to do self-determination. One of my friends actually just published a book about that. And there are a lot of different ways to think about governance that aren't always about putting your own ethnic group in a state and going from there. And I hope that helps them when the time comes to imagine another possibility for Israel-Palestine other than the ones that seem to be on the table, which seem to be, you know, impossibly, very difficult to achieve movement of peoples to make some kind of Palestinian and some kind of Israeli state. I think that's very difficult at this point. It was possible maybe back in the 80s, but I don't think a two-state solution is possible now.
Yeah.
But the other possibility seems to be, a state in which one or the other group is quite dominant. And, of course, it's most likely to be Israel. But as I used to say to a friend of mine, well, you know, it's one state, and right now it's Israel. In 50 years, it's going to be Palestine, because that's the way the numbers are going, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, my students are surprising me, but they aren't. So it's not like they are all sitting around going, you know, free, free Palestine, we hate Israel. That's not what they're doing. They're trying to think through how this could be solved in a way that doesn't ask anybody to leave their homes. And that's very, you know, I really appreciate their ethics around that. It's just very difficult to do.
Yeah. With the... that student who asked the question, it's so powerful of can both be oppressed, because that gets a lot of flack with people thinking that there's this very clean sever in the world of seeing it of oppressor and oppressed, and your job is to just figure out which one is which and then support the oppressed, and that's kind of the end of the end of politics and the end of ethics. I would like for you to react to that, of how you maybe, even yourself, try to complicate that picture when it comes to something like Israel-Palestine and your work, or is that kind of the right way to look at it? You could even maybe fold in your, the title of this diary, this book that you put out.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the three promises, which seem to be trying to address this mess that we're in.
Well, I think that at one level, I don't see it as complicated. I do think the Israelis are oppressing the Palestinians, yeah. and that's the fundamental reality on the ground. And that has been the fundamental reality for a very long time, for many decades. We're in a moment where two things, impossible things, seem to be the case at the same time. One is that we might really, at one level, there's a push for Palestinian sovereignty, Palestinian state, that we've never seen in my lifetime. And that possibility that that could actually happen seems, when you're in certain circles, seems just tangible. Even if it's not going to happen next week, it seems like the idea of Israel as a sanctified place that's doing everything right, has to be protected, has really been shattered by, even for a lot of not people on the left, but just ordinary people who aren't even that political, are no longer feeling that great about Israel. So it being protected in the way that it has been by the United States, or having that kind of moral status, just seems over. But on the other hand, there's nothing that I see, nothing that anybody's doing, that really seems to me to be at the big meta level, at the geostrategic political level, nation state level. Is anybody doing anything to make a Palestine happen? It just feels to me like the disconnect between what people, ordinary people in Europe, in the Middle East, in the U.S., elsewhere think, and what their leaders are doing is stunning. And so we have a whole sea change in attitude, and at the same time, the European Union, the United States are rushing to help the Israelis solidify their control again over whatever parts of Gaza they want, again over the West Bank. They're moving. People are coming out of the settlements. They're taking land every single day. It looks to me like Palestine is being eaten alive at the same time. And so I don't feel super hopeful right now. I know that some people do, but I feel like we're seeing a lot of, I feel like, you know, there was a sea change in attitudes in the United States toward Native Americans just about the time that Native Americans became no longer politically powerful enough to make a real claim.
Yeah. When you start understanding the large systems potentially that are the engine behind the oppression of the Palestinians and many, many other people in the world, they're the focal point. I guess I'm asking this question of, like, because you lived through it from the previous generation, like, global revolution seems to sort of be in the air. And where do, in some ways I'm saying, how do we take the focus from Palestine to the world in order to free Palestine rather than ourselves? Or is that a mistake? Or is it just hyper-focus on Palestine? It's like, I don't even know how to formulate the question and the concern I have. But it feels like the world is fed up with what's happened to the Palestinians, but they know it's indicative of a global system. And your students must be feeling that too. It's no surprise to me that American history students are in the street.
And that the people who are South Asian or Latino or African in background now recognize fully that Palestine is the symbolic center of a struggle that they are also part of.
Yeah.
And so everybody understands that it's not because the only bad things in the world are happening in Palestine.
Yeah.
It's because some very bad things have been happening in Palestine, and they are happening in a way that is emblematic of and symbolic of the kind of struggle that is ongoing to create genuinely post-colonial societies, genuinely decolonial contexts that got rid of the formal colonial rule. That was the struggle against colonialism, but yet the structures of capitalism, the structures of racism, the ways that technology has been distributed, all of these things have meant that a lot of folks who were coming to GW come from countries that have remained poor, that have remained underdeveloped, that have remained without really functioning democracies. And so that sense that this is symbolic of all sorts of unkept promises, that the promises that I talk about in the book are, I talk about the three promises that were made to, you know, people in Israel, Palestine, but really there are a lot of promises that came out of Bandung, that came out of the anti-colonial struggle, a lot of dreams for a more genuinely equal world that was not built on oppression. It was also not built on extraction of one thing after another to the point of destroying the worlds that people might want to live in.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I talked about, I was just at the American Studies conference and I was on a panel called American Studies After Gaza. And I ended up talking, everybody had their own thing, but I ended up talking about a lot of comparisons between the Vietnam War and Gaza in terms of how they impacted their American audiences, so to speak, how they had influence in the United States. And one of the things I argued is that, you know, after Vietnam was the era of human rights. That, you know, before that, there was, you know, a kind of liberal Americanism that basically got, American liberalism basically got destroyed in Vietnam. And after it came this kind of politics without politics. There's a human rights thing that says, we don't care if you're left, right, or center. There's just some things you shouldn't do, and we're going to stand up for that wherever we see it. And human rights, in that sense, it has a lot of good things going for it. But everyone has known who's been paying attention that it has been honored in the breach as much as in the protection of it, right? And that human rights are not equally protected. I mean, Hannah Arendt talked about this in the early 1960s, the right to have rights is not something that everybody has. And you see certain places where people get all worked up about human rights violations and certain places where they don't. So it's never been fully functioning, to say the least. It's been, you know, really a, what one person I know calls a thin tissue of human rights holding certain things together. But I really believe that even more than the war on terror, where the idea of human rights as a universal really took a battering with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and rendition and all of that stuff, it didn't unfold. The war on terror and those terrible things that were happening that the United States was largely behind didn't unfold in front of our eyes the way that Gaza did, and it was over a much longer period of time. So I think it was Gaza that ended the human rights era. That the level of hypocrisy, violence, double talk, invisibility. I mean, for those of us who were watching, we saw people, we saw this happening in front of us on YouTube or on Instagram, but many people didn't even know, didn't even see. It was hidden from them. But nonetheless, people knew that violence was happening, that mass killing was happening, and there was an uprising and a worldwide kind of speaking out against it, and yet nothing stopped it. And I think that that has ended for us any ability to claim human rights as a politics. And so we ended up talking, well, what comes next? And I said, we actually kind of know what comes next. What comes next has to be a planetary consciousness. It has to be a planetary consciousness that includes the non-human. It has to have an ecology at its base about living in a sustainable way. And it has to take seriously the lives of non-human beings, of the Earth, all of that stuff. Because we're at a moment when the kind of logic of the late 20th century, early 21st century that imagined that, or tried to imagine that after the Cold War, we were going to work this out through some kind of, you know, universal state and human rights being part of that, just failed. It just failed tremendously.
Yeah. I mean, is that the end of the UN? Of the, like, I always think of this as a historian, like you think of, it's there's kind of an obvious punctuation mark where you have a global system getting itself in trouble with empires, then having a massive world war, and everyone's like, man, that was really bad. I don't want to do that again. Let's get together and make a table. We'll call it the League of Nations. Oh, it's pretty flawed. That failed pretty quickly. And then we have another even more massive fight. Oh, that was really bad. Let's get together and have a table and not do it again. We'll call this one the United Nations. And it's, people could fill in the blank of the next sentence of that, which it seems to be like we can go one of two ways right here, because I mean, I think that's incredible.
The United Nations, the first thing it did was the UN Declaration of Human Rights, right? Those two things are intimately intertwined.
And almost its first act was to create Israel-Palestine, and literally the thing that will, it's like the test of the United Nations.
I think that it's quite clear to me that the United Nations has no chance of being an effective arbiter of world anything. They have done some important things. They really have. The UN military forces that have sometimes gone in between fighting powers have been very important. It's not been, a terrible idea at one level, but at another level, it has been so useless in so many ways. And again, one of the reasons that I still believe that the Israelis can and should have the right to have some kind of self-determination in the territory that they're in. Self-determination may be being voting members of a multinational state, or it may be whatever it means, is that the UN did found Israel.
Yeah.
And as much as that was deeply problematic, and in fact, I think an immoral decision, I know why they made it, I know why they felt like it was the right thing to do, but it's all we had. Like, so if you either you say that what the UN did in these periods we have to live with and build from, or you ignore it altogether, and then there's no standard or structure we can work from to say where do we land on how international conflicts can be resolved. If we're going to start quoting UN resolution X or Y or Z, we have to think about what we mean by abiding by what the UN says.
I'm going to ask.
I would say ultimately I land on a flawed idea. And I think that ultimately we're going to have something very different. I wish to God I was the person who could tell you what that would be and could, save the world that way, but I'm not quite sure.
For today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very interesting question. And that question is related to an ethical issue. And one of the characteristics that is considered a vice, a moral vice, in Islam in particular and in religion in general. I'm speaking, of course, of self-admiration. As you know, self-admiration or self-satisfaction, you might say, being satisfied with oneself, admiring oneself, having a very high opinion of oneself, estimating one's worth more than it really is. These are characteristics that are considered morally reprehensible and, not only in Islam, but also in religion and society in general tends to frown upon such people. Today on The Key, the question we want to pose today with respect to this topic is, according to Islam, what are the effects that result from such a trait? If somebody adopts such a trait, what will happen? In order to answer this very significant question, we can take recourse to an inspiration from some of the hadiths which have been narrated from our infallibles, alayhim salam, regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith which has been narrated in the Nahjul Balagha, in the section on the aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported as having said this: Man radhiya an nafsihi kathura sakhitu alayh, which can be translated as, he who admires himself attracts many opponents against him. Right? Which means that, you know, if somebody admires himself more than he deserves to, you know, people will begin to oppose such a person, and it will lead to enmity and create you know, animosity in the people for him. In explaining this beautiful hadith, Sayyid Razi, the compiler of the Nahjul Balagha, says the following. In the last phrase, because this is hadith is a part of a more lengthier hadith, in this last phrase, Imam Ali alayhi salam has described the consequences and effects resulting from self-admiration, namely that it creates the feeling of hatred and humiliation in others. Thus, the man who manifests his greatness by every pretext in order to make himself conspicuous is never regarded with esteem. People begin to despise him because of his mental or psychological condition in seeking self-conspicuity, and they are not prepared to accord him the worth he really has, much less to regard him as he himself thinks to be, meaning they don't even give him the value that he really has. Right? They begin to view him in lesser than what he really is. These are the effects of self-admiration in light of the infallibles. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the effects of self-admiration in the light of the hadith of the infallibles. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Good morning, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Audio Shelf. Today I'm going to read to you parts of the book Unwithering Flames about Shahid Abbas Babai. Please stay tuned. Abbas Babai, born December 5, 1950, assigned to pilot training in the U.S., 1969 to 1972, married to Malihe Hikmat, August 26, 1975, martyred on August 6, 1987, Sardasht. Stay a bit longer. It seemed like truth and death were two sides of the same coin, and the man had found truth. On the night of the departure, over 100 people had gathered in our small house to say their goodbyes. Abbas asked me to go to our old house with him, which wasn't far from our new house, formerly the base's power station. We went there to exchange our last words. There were some things that he wanted me to do while I was away. Tears had covered his entire face. I didn't want my departure, the moment of our separation, to be bitter. "Take care of yourself if I'm not here when you return," he said. I had heard this before. I couldn't take it anymore. How could I bear your absence? How could you not be here? My love for God is the foundation of my life, but you have become a beautiful and important part of it. I yearn to be with you, and I believe that together we can build a relationship that honors both my devotion to God and the love we share. I hope that my love for you will never ever conflict with the love for God. Abbas said this with tears still resting on his face. I went quiet. What could I say? I was busy mulling over my trip, and he, Malihe, one who has found his divine love, must leave all else behind, he said. He continued, "Let me watch you as you walk." "Huh? What do you mean?" I asked, confused. "I want to see how you look in your ihram." I walked around and he looked at me like he was looking at me for the first time, like the night when he and his family came to ask for my hand in marriage. "That's enough. People are waiting," I said. "No, let's stay a bit longer," Abbas replied. Just when we were about to leave the house, he went and brought me one of my shirts, a long-sleeve violet shirt with a floral pattern made from a light fabric that my mother had bought from Mecca. "Wear this there," he said, while handing me the shirt. When we got home, everybody jokingly asked us why these conversations of ours took so long. The buses were waiting for us at the mosque. All of the other travelers were friends or colleagues of Abbas, along with their wives. While in the front yard of the mosque, Abbas pulled me aside. Knowing how much I loved peaches, he had bought some just for me. It felt like the early days of our engagement all over again. We found a quiet corner and savored the peaches together. When the kids approached us, he gently told them, "Go to your grandmother. I want to be alone with your mother." The bus was waiting for me. All the other passengers had already boarded. Finally, it was time for us to part ways. There was a man standing next to the bus, reciting Maddahi and Salawat. "All recite a Salawat for Shahid Babai's health," he suddenly said aloud. My feet couldn't move any longer.
This is Audio Shelf on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
I turned and asked Abbas, "What is he saying?" "This too is God's work," he said. My legs couldn't move. I took a step ahead, but my worries were dragging me back. When I boarded the bus, I couldn't make sense of any of the other passengers, even though they were all my acquaintances. As the bus started to move, my eyes were fixated on him, the one who had boarded the bus to send me off, and I started crying. I switched seats with Miss Ardestani so that I could still see him when the bus moved farther. The thought of this being the last time that I would see him made me uneasy. For the last time, I saw him from the window as he looked up and smiled. He had one hand on his chest while he was waving at me with the other. That was the last moment I had of him, forever etched in my mind. After all these years, I still remember that final smile. Now, I've grown used to him being present and me unable to see him. I know he's watching over. He's with us, and he protects us. Without his ethereal presence, I would never have been able to endure the difficult life I faced after his martyrdom. Sometimes, I hear him knocking. I can even hear him cough sometimes. Before my daughter was married, she used to see him often. Just before she got married, one of our family friends came and told us that a bus had been visiting him in his dreams. A bus had told him that there was a suitor for our daughter, and had even told him the groom's name, all of which came true in the end. I lived with a bus for 11 years, and I'm still living with him. Even when he was in America, he thought of me as his future wife, unbeknownst to me. Although he is no longer with us anymore, he is still my husband. Sometimes I get palpitations, and that's when I feel his presence and even catch his scent around me. Now I know why he was so insistent that I find a job. Every time I ring the bell as principal at the school I work at, I drown myself in the kids' childish clamor.
Stories about famous martyrs of Iran in Audio Shelf, only on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
The Pious Pilot, Northrop F-5 Pilot Training Camp, Reese Air Base, Lubbock, Texas, USA, 1971. Intelligence report. Abbas Babai, the Iranian student, is described as abnormal in his file. He performs daily prayers. At a time when everyone bragged about their debauchery and partying all the time, he stayed away from such things. He had even gone to the extent of limiting his interaction with his drunken roommates by splitting the room with a cord. He didn't even drink Pepsi, he said. The company supports Israel. When the commander of the airbase, Colonel Baxter, returned to his office, he was met by the young man he had summoned. The young Iranian's face looked familiar. The colonel remembered one night when he was coming back from a night of partying with his wife, when he had seen him running into the courtyard to purge the devil from within himself. And now the young man was bowing and prostrating over the newspapers he had laid out on his office's floor. Later, when he finished his prayers, he explained that this was one of the obligations of his religion. Since the colonel had not yet arrived, and that specific moment was the time to perform his prayers, he performed his prayers. He spoke English slowly but fluently. That interested the colonel as he studied the rest of the reports in his file. He looked at the young man. His pictures from back then displayed a young man with a handsome face and stubble. He was wearing a thick leather belt around his jeans and was sitting happily around a formica table with his friends. The colonel approved his file. Abbas was now a pilot. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us with this episode of Audio Shelf. We hope you enjoyed parts of the book, Unwithering Flames, about Shahid Abbas Babai. Don't forget to log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Till another episode and another story. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We'll start off this hour's programs with Youth Station, a program all about young people and dealing with topics related to youth. Next is Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about the current events and issues in the West Asia region. That will be followed by Back to Reality. In this roundtable discussion, young Muslims are invited to discuss some pertinent religious and social issues of today's Islamic world. Our varied radio productions feature will be next.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this episode of Youth Station. My name is Muhammad and I am here with Sister...
This is Nahid, having the honor of being with you.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
We previously started talking about the throwaway culture, the culture that is pushing many of the young people, mostly young people, towards this idea, this mindset that we can throw everything away once we don't need them. Be it the people, be it the materials, be it whatever around us. And then we came to this idea that not everything can be removed. And not this idea, this whole mindset is going to be considered and blamed as something negative. Mm-hmm. So as for today, let's talk about this this idea, this question, that how can I draw my limitations? I mean, okay, I'm young. I know that this throwaway culture that I see on the social media, that I see with all the people around me, has to be controlled. But my question is how to draw this limitation. Should I just write down and jot down the things that are all around me and the surrounding of myself? Or should I go for a wiser version and start reading books? How can I find my limitations? How can I teach myself and train my mind on this culture? How can I control it?
I think I can start this discussion with a verse from the Quran. Anchor this discussion with this verse, and it's a very shocking verse. It's in chapter 17, Surah Isra of the Quran, verse number 26 and 27. Now, this verse actually is talking about giving to the relatives, وَآتِ ذَا الْقَرْبَ حَقَّهُ, and give the relative his right, and also the poor and the traveler, and so on, ibn al-Sabil. And then at the end, it says, وَلَا تُبَذِّرْ تَبْذِيرًا, and do not spend wastefully. Now, this is something extremely... Why should you talk about spending wastefully in a verse that talks about generosity, that talks about giving?
Yeah.
Even in your generosity, don't be wasteful. And then further, and it doesn't stop here. It doesn't say don't be wasteful in your spending and that's it. The verse after that is even more shocking. إِنَّ الْمُبَذِّرِينَ كَانُوا إِخْوَانَ الشَّيَاطِينَ. Those who waste, indeed, the wasteful are the brothers of devils. Now, we're talking about generosity here. Those who are wasteful in their generosity, in their giving their rights to others, they're wasteful in that. Now, let alone us being wasteful in things that are not necessarily right for others. It's ours. We have the money. But we're still wasteful in that. We're still doing israf. We're doing tabdhir, according to this verse. This is something really that shocks us, that the Quran doesn't talk about money. It talks about a mindset. That, you know, framework of thinking. Like when waste becomes a habit, it shapes who we are. When we are wasteful in
even
our...
Even if it's in generosity.
Exactly. Who we are the brothers of Shaitan. We're the brothers of the devil. So this mindset, I can remember, like, I hate people, and this is something that comes from the bottom of my heart. I hate people who see, for example, and this is something that I also have a phobia as well, who write, for example, half a page, and then they have to throw away what they've written. They scrap their entire page and throw it away.
Oh.
Why don't you just tear that small... You know, when I was doing labs for my high school, I can clearly remember my notebook. All of my friends had finished their entire 100-page notebooks writing their labs, but I barely made the 50-page mark.
Because now, you were using it well.
That was not the only case. The thing is, I had more notes than my friends. Like, I could literally count the number of words in my page, and I can easily say they were double. First of all, I was writing very thin and small. Second of all, I would not even spare the borders of this page. This page on the Day of Judgment would be complaining against me as to why the hell did you use so much of me? Even the borders, you did not leave it for myself. That's how keen I was. Not to say that I'm really good at this.
This is how a Muslim has to be. We are recommended to avoid Islam.
Exactly. Not because we have abundance of something means that we should be wasteful.
Yeah.
When we had an abundance of it, we wasted so much, both in terms of agriculture, we had a lot of farmers wasting water in a very bad manner, both in terms of our personal lives. It's a very common thing that we waste because it's so industrialized. You know, I think sometimes we look back in the ages before us, in the eras before us. I think sometimes some of these technological advancements should be undoed, you know, control Z.
Yeah.
We should go back.
In our relationships, in the way we are bonding with people, in every perspective we have to be aware. We have hadith in Islam that is mentioning mending relationships is better than excessive prayer and fasting.
Exactly.
See, mending relationships versus fasting and prayer.
Look at what's being compared here. Praying and fasting, which is some of the most important aspects of one's religion.
The things that are the nearest to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, exactly. And you're comparing that to mending relationships.
Yeah.
Now, repair when repair is possible. That's extremely important. That's the message you're giving from Islam. Islam doesn't say stay in harm, stay in a toxic relationship, but it says that don't cut off people or don't cut off things or don't throw away things just because it's easier, just because you feel more comfortable, convenient. Mend wherever you can, and that is extremely important for us as Gen Zs. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I have wasted a lot myself. I can remember my teacher. I was traveling once with him, and he had his family in the vehicle as well.
Right.
And all of a sudden, one of his daughters, she sneezed, and she wanted a tissue paper from my teacher too, because we were in the front and they were at the back and so. So he took out a piece of the tissue paper, and you know how tissues are, right?
Yeah.
They have like two layers glued between them. So what he did, he very delicately, while driving, and don't do this, guys, this is not safe for driving, very delicately, he separated the two layers, and he tore half of it and said, don't do israf. And this really got me, like, look at how he is thinking. Me, personally, when I come out of, for example, bathroom after washing my hands, take out the tissue papers, and just, you know, it's so cheap, it's so abundant, like, you can easily get one. We have, like, stocks of them at home. We buy a bundle of tissue papers and we just stock it. It's so cheap, like there's nothing harm in, you know, use. But then look at this guy. Although it's cheap, it's an abundance. My teacher, I really appreciate and I really pray for the things he has taught me. May Allah protect him wherever he is.
Inshallah.
He is so keen in how he is using that two layer of
and
tissue paper.
And it doesn't
paper.
Mean